You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, June 19th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
So, which of you guys are watching the series Black Sails?
Not me.
I saw every episode. The last season, though, I've only just started.
It's the last season I saw. So I saw the season finale. What an amazing series. Kara, if you haven't watched it, it's only like 38, 39 episodes over four seasons. Just binge the whole thing. It's really awesome.
What's it on? FX? AMC?
Stars. It's on Stars.
Stars. I do have that network. I shall watch.
I didn't find this out until I was almost done with the series, but it's actually a prequel to Treasure Island, to the book Treasure Island.
Oh, cool.
But they expand a lot on, you know, the prehistory, like the pirates who were, they're legends in the time of the book, you know, Treasure Island, but they really flesh out their stories. But what I love about it is the writing. You know, we talked about like the Alien movie and how it was terrible because the plot keeps getting advanced by the characters being incredibly stupid to the point that it takes you out of the story.
Yeah.
What I love about Black Sails more than any other series I've ever seen is that the plot is consistently driven by every character being bold, like direct and smart, you know.
Oh,
sometimes
nice.
Naked. Well, smart is key.
Sometimes naked.
Naked,
but it's amazing.
Too.
They're just so. I mean, that's you could tell that the writer's like, all right, every character is just going to be balls to the walls, fearless and bold, and that just every episode just amazing. And it's amazing how well that could drive plot.
It is incredible. The acting and the writing and even the cinematography are just top notch. And if you hear pirate and you're thinking, "Arr," you know, and peg leg and walk the plank, don't even go there. As awesome as that is, it's not that at all.
There is a keel hauling. There is a keel hauling.
And it's so dense. The plot and the machinations can be so dense that sometimes I feel like I need to watch the episode again just to really follow the details of what exactly is happening. It's not lighthearted stuff. This stuff, the political intrigue, it reminds me literally of Game of Thrones. It is, some of the actors are just so over the top that I just, in a good way, they're just so good. Cause you know how pirates are. Any pirates, I don't care if it's a cheesy pirates or the serious pirates, they are, like Steve said, when they say stuff, it's often quite dramatic. Right, it's piratey stuff. It's gonna not be. Give me a cream puff. It's gonna be something that has weight to it. And these actors pull it off time after time after time. They say this. They say sentences that most people would sound very goofy and very silly and not pull it off. They pull it off every time.
And I love the fact that they're all recognizably pirates, but none of them are cliche. You know what I mean? It's weird. They really it's just a fantastic job. I love everything about the series. So if you're looking for a series to binge over the summer, highly recommend Black Sails.
The intro itself is worth watching. The intro is wonderful.
That's good because I did binge Orange is the New Black, and so I'm low again. I need a new hit.
How was that?
I love Orange is the New Black.
I mean, good things about it.
Yeah, it's a really good show. It is over the top in that it's kind of got like a fantastic quality to it. Everything's slightly overacted. Everything's a little bit stilted. That's just the tone of the show. But once you kind of accept that and you understand it, it's really quite good.
Yeah, it's good. You know, I think the bar is so high now. There's such mm-hmm. good programming on TV. That's why when you watch something that's mediocre, it's like, this is shit.
Yeah.
Come on. This is not what I'm expecting.
So, you know, a lot of Star Trek fans on this show, but I watched the trailer for the new Star Trek series, mm-hmm. Star Trek Discovery, that's coming out supposedly this year, and it really does look like the TV show is fully movie quality. Like, if they just said, this is a movie, you would think, yep, that's a trailer to a movie.
But how's the writing going to be? Again, you know, I'll be so disappointed if they don't have decent writers.
Well, that's stuff we won't know. And one big concern, things have happened with this new show that are concerning. They had picked a showrunner initially that was a wonderful choice. This was a guy that is well known in the Star Trek world, the Star Trek universe, mm-hmm. makes great ideas. Everybody had confidence in him to be a great showrunner. And then he was gone. Something happened. He left. And everyone's like, oh, now what's going to happen? So that was a big hit that it took, if you're kind of following some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. So, and I'm still not sure. Yeah, Jay, you're right. The preview looked really good. The trailer looked wonderful. But, you know, you never know. You can't
of course, put
too much into the trailer. So we'll see. We'll see. But it looks wonderful so far.
Not that we have any expectations about Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah, not that you guys are interested in that sort of thing.
We're not invested in that franchise.
I was concerned. Were you guys concerned about the setting, the time frame? You know, before classic Trek?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I do like that.
That's fine.
Because it's grittier. Because they ruined everything. Everything is too advanced. Past the Captain Kirk years, they've ruined everything. The prequels are more gritty because they can't just like transport everywhere, and you know what I mean. It's actually has much more potential. They're more raw and out there.
I don't know, Steve. I don't know if I agree with that. I want to see stuff that's going on after Next Gen. Cutting some new ground here. You're kind of straitjacketed a little bit. You can't make the crazy moves that you could make in an open end, uncharted territory like after Next Gen. With this, you can't do. There's things you can't do. You just can't do it. You know, unless you're talking alternate timeline, then all bets
or
are off.
Or how about this new plot lines? They could create and destroy entire civilizations for all I care. Yeah, you can't kill off the Romulans because we know they're going to be around later on. But it forces them to write new plot lines. There's a whole frigging universe out there. Just do it.
I'm fine with that, Bob. I don't care like that. They're on a timeline and they have to follow that. The bottom line is, I want to see great character development. I want to see relationships on the screen, and I want the stakes to be high in a sci-fi Star Trek environment. That's the formula.
And bold characters making bold decisions, right?
I like prequels.
Yeah, I do too, Kara.
I think prequels are great because there are a lot of unanswered questions in some of our favorite like lore. And okay, my example of this, because I'm not a Star Trek nerd, would be Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Like, I've been watching Better Call Saul, as probably a lot of people listening have.
It's very good.
Yeah, and anybody who loved Breaking Bad really wants to know what happened to Salamanca. And we're going to find out soon. And it's so cool to see like how people got to where they were and how they have the features and the character traits that they have in the prequel.
That's the thing. And people have written that about Better Call Saul, that what's interesting is if you watched the Breaking Bad, you know where they get to.
Mm-hmm, and but you don't know how they got there.
They don't know how they got there. Not only that, they set up very interesting situations like, holy shit, how are we going to get to point B from point A? So that's how you make a prequel interesting. How are we going to get from what they're setting up to where I know we're going to end up? And that could be really intriguing.
And that's the great thing about, you know, what you can do when there are good quintessential characters that are good and evil, because it's so great to see how did the evil person become the evil person? What happened along their lifespan, or, you know, what kind of great war were they involved in, blah, 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 in order to have them become the nemesis later. And especially when characters are really complex, where they were like the good guy at one point in history and then something bad happened and they turned. Like, that's always
fun. What does that sound
like?
I mean, you're basically talking about Darth Vader, right?
Oh,
I'm trying to sound like Darth Vader. Was that good?
That was a snoring Jedi.
I think that was Sleepy from
Cracking
Old White.
Kara, just say the words whole purr very breathy and you'll get it.
Whole purr?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a little creepy.
Like that. Whole purr. Yeah, there you go.
Don't do that again.
Okay. All right.
All right, Kara, get us started with what's the word?
Ooh, the word this week is a fun one. It was recommended by Jay Schneiderman. And he says, as someone who works in human spaceflight, cool, Jay, I have found a word that non-space nerds always think I'm misspelling or mispronouncing. If you listen or watch a lot of coverage from NASA or other space agencies, you're likely to run into them. So I think it would make an interesting what's the word. The word is nominal, and it's often confused for normal. Nominal in engineering, especially aerospace, means within acceptable limits or as according to plan or design. However, this has about half a dozen different meanings outside of aerospace. This makes it a contronym/auto antonym, as depending on the context, it can mean within an expected value range or well below the expected value. That is actually really interesting. And then he says, I'd like to know more about the different usages and etymology. Well, let's do it then, Jay.
Engage. Thank you
for the, yeah, thanks for the recommendation. It was a great one. So it's true. When you look at definitions across dictionaries, they're, yeah, it's right around a half a dozen definitions. Now, the first one that always pops up, because it is really related to the etymology of the word, is the relationship to a noun or a name. So something is nominal, mean if it is noun ish. It's an adjective referring to a noun or relating to a noun, but it's also an adjective relating to or referring to a name. So here we go. The streets have names like Third Avenue, but the resemblance to Manhattan is only nominal. So it's an adjective referring to the word noun or name. But then it gets a little more interesting. As he sort of mentioned, existing or being something in name or form only of being or relating to a designated or theoretical size that may vary from the actual. So an approximation. I think this is a common usage in engineering. So the nominal size of something is the size of it on its plans, but then there's going to be an actual size that might be a little bit different. But usually, so long as it's within a certain range or within certain limits, then it's nominally acceptable. Does that make sense to everybody?
It does.
Okay. And then there's more. In economics, expressed in terms of current prices or figures without making allowance for changes over time. So the nominal exchange rate would be the exchange rate right now as we are describing it. And then, of course, as mentioned by Jay, here's a really random sort of subuse, but it's one that we use a lot. Trifling or insignificant. That person only had a nominal involvement in the project. Or, you know, I only got paid a nominal amount for that job. So when Jay mentioned that it could mean right around the same or it could mean significantly less than, that's what he was talking about. And then lastly, look at this. Informal. This is in Oxford's dictionary. It's not actually in Merriam-Webster, which is the American standard. Informal, chiefly in the context of space travel, functioning nominally or acceptably. So it gets its own definition there because it sort of relates to the engineering definition, but generally that is referring to plans for physical manufacturing. So, you know, a pipeline or something. But if something is functioning nominally, it is functioning acceptably. So when we dig into the etymology, we really get a good. Oh, also, nominal is used sometimes in statistics. It can be a type of variable which has like levels, but they're qualitative levels. It's something you can't put a number on. Like hair color would be a nominal variable. You know, you're either redhead, you know, brown hair, blonde hair, or white hair. That's nominal. There's not really a number you can ascribe to that. Okay. So when we look at the etymology, it's an old word around the 15th century. It started in Latin. And it really does come down to that noun or name definition, which I think were sort of interchangeable back then. So pertaining to nouns or pertaining to names, it really all came from that word name. And then as it started to evolve around the 1620s is when we first saw a use of the word as referring to something being in name only. So you can kind of see how the word shifted over the years to either the name of something or only in name, because they still relate to the same root. And really, in a way, that kind of describes the shift to a nominal value, because it was the named value on the blueprint. That was the original value. That was the name. And then I guess I could see that moving out from there in the context of space travel, although I don't know the etymology of that change. If something is functioning nominally, then it is functioning acceptably. But I guess it does still kind of relate to within normal limits.
Yeah, within acceptable parameters is kind of
exactly
how I always interpret it.
And that all sort of were iterations coming out of this idea of like as relating to the name, the first name or the noun. So the first descriptor became those limits. And so long as something functioned within those limits, then it was still nominal. Nominal, damn it.
Nominable.
Right. Oh, the last word I said, too, is a nominal cranius, you guys. Ah, shit.
Carrie, you know what? Last week's word was volatile.
Mm-hmm.
And I came across a use of the word that I knew
that
about.
We didn't cover?
But I don't think we covered it last week. Did we cover volatile and non-volatile computer memory?
No, we absolutely did not.
Damn, how the hell did I not
think of
that?
Right?
Awesome.
So
yeah.
You know what that means? A volatile memory is memory that goes away when you turn off the computer.
That makes
the
sense.
Power
it's like fleeting.
Off. It's fleeting. And non-volatile memory is like your hard drive. It stays there even when it's not powered. It doesn't have to be refreshed, et cetera. It's more stable.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, volatile and non-volatile memory.
Yeah, I love these adapted uses where even though they don't directly relate to the original etymology, which as we remember from volatile meant flying, physically flying, like birds and butterflies were volatiles, it also you can see the chain as the language evolves. Flying becomes ethereal, it becomes fleeting, and all of a sudden it can be related to all of these other usages.
Yeah.
I love
it.
So cool. Interesting.
All right, Jay, get us started on the news items. This is also a computer-related news item. This one is cool.
Yeah.
Guys, what are humans better at than computers?
Pattern recognition. Crying.
Love.
All right, I heard pattern recognition, lying,
crying.
And love.
I said crying.
Yes.
Crying. Oh, crying.
Common sense.
All right.
We're not better at poker.
I do have some right answers were given.
Okay.
With nominal interpretation.
Some of them.
So one of the things that humans can do better is unstructured problem solving. These are problems like problems that exist with no rules. For example, a good idea would be like think about a person writing a piece of software. A piece of software could have thousands of problems to solve, puzzles to solve, and you really don't know what the specifics are until you get there. Second idea here is acquiring and processing new information. So deciding what is the relevant information from like this huge flood of information that you can get like doing research online. It's complicated to parse through all that data and figure out what's real, what's legit, and even what you're reading needs to be interpreted as well. Even if it's a good source, you have to be able to interpret that data. Arguably, not many people can do this really well, but humans can do this much, much better than a software or AI can do. An example here would be, you know, a scientist discovering properties of medicine. You couldn't set an AI out to do that yet. Their processing power and the computational power is just not there for it to do it. And the artificial intelligence can't handle that type of thinking. Another thing would be non-routine physical work. So these are just any task in the 3D world, climbing a tree. You know, we could do that way better than machines can do. As of today, we still can drive cars. Maybe, but that's changed, right? That's changing very quickly.
It's evolving.
Yeah.
And the final one, and Kara hit on this, is being human. Just emotions, being able to comfort each other, being empathic, being able to express yourself artistically, showing emotions, being humorous. It's a
social interactions in general.
Exactly, right? Just it's a combination of all the things that our brain does, that the perception part of it, the expressing part of it, the interpretation of human emotions and body language and all that. Just it's a monumental thing to do that our brains are so good at, and AI can't do it yet. But a lot of what humans do is based on something called relational reasoning. But check this out. Researchers at Google's DeepMind claim they've developed an algorithm that is very good. It's quite good at handling this kind of reasoning. In fact, it's already beaten humans at complex image comprehension. So let me give you a little bit of background, then I'll tell you what DeepMind can do now. There are two different kinds of artificial intelligence, or there might be others, but these are the two primary kinds. Statistical and symbolic. Statistical AI, also known as machine learning, is really good at pattern recognition, but it's not good at raw logic. Symbolic AI is good at determining relationships between things with a healthy set of predetermined rules, but it's not good at learning things on the fly. But Google has come up with a way to fill in all these holes that exist in these two types of AI. They use two different kinds of artificial intelligence. Now, it's an artificial neural network that can perform relational reasoning. It functions kind of like the way the human brain does today, that has connections between different centers that can do different things really well. So, Steve, give me an example of two or three different places in the brain that communicate to each other, and together they make Voltron.
Well, you know, like, the whole brain communicates with itself in a way, so
it's hard to even narrow it down. But there's all, but yeah. Your brain is communicating with itself, like in a global sense, meaning that it's using all of its different resources to parse through the information and to produce thoughts, feelings, and reality to us. Right?
Like with language, for example, there's actually just a recent study looking at language processing. When we're hunting for a word, that ranges over wide parts of the brain because, you know, we're conceptually searching our understanding of the world in order to find the best word that fits it.
So what there's so many things.
Yeah, you're
like
right,
Carrie.
Vision
and hearing and all those things feed together in that.
And memory and everything. It all probably, on some level, I bet it's all being used all the time. You know, it's just always like being pinged on everything that's going on. So what they did at DeepMind was they took this concept and they said, you know, they use this thing called neural nets that connects tiny programs that work together to find patterns. Now, they've developed this specialized architecture, and it's really good at different things. Like, as an example, one architecture they have is good at processing image, where another would be good at learning games or parsing a language. So as an example, they challenged their software to answer questions about the relationship between objects that were found in a single image. So visualize you have a cylinder, balls, and cubes that are all in the same image. They would ask the software the following question. There is an object in front of the blue thing. Does it have the same shape as the tiny cyan thing that is to the right of the gray metal ball? That's a complicated question to ask a piece of software. So what the software does is it has different specialty programs now that are doing different processing at the same time. One is really good at processing images, while the other is really good at maybe, you know, parsing through the differences in the colors. And in that neural network that connects them, that is the bridge between them, takes the aggregate of what these two pieces of software do. And they, keeping in mind, they're communicating with each other. They're sharing information through this neural network. And you know what? It works. And from what DeepMind said, the researchers at DeepMind, they said it's a really simple concept. This thing is actually not that complicated, you know, when you think about it. I'm sure that there's massive complexity in the software itself, but the way that they're connecting them and they're using this neural network to have them communicate with each other makes it's basic. It makes a lot of sense. It's easy to understand. Now, check this out. Here's the statistics from that question I asked. And existing machine learning algorithms were correct 42 to 77% of the time in that spectrum. Humans could score a really good 92% of the time. Google's relation network software was correct 96% of the time. It beat human thinking out in answering the question. DeepMind pulled off a couple of other really cool things too, but the one that was really impressive, the one I thought was just really interesting, was that it was able to figure out after looking at an animation of balls, 10 balls bouncing, that some of them were connected by invisible springs or rods just by looking at the patterns of motion. Now, think about that. There's 10 balls moving around a screen. Now, to a human eye, you can almost visualize, yeah, those two are connected. They're moving in synergistically, right? They're moving with some relationship to each other. We could do that. But this software was able to see that animation and suss out that it was a rod or a spring that was connecting those two, you know, so it developed a relationship between some of the objects on the screen. That is some serious thinking right there.
That's cool.
Yeah, so the thing is, this is the beginning of what I think is really a simulated brain. Because imagine, like, they're saying, yeah, two or three different little pieces of software that are expert at one thing, that do one thing really good, and they're connected. Now they can talk to each other. Ramp it up. Take, you know, 1,000 pieces of software that are good at these little things that can communicate to each other. And you can
Do you think they could teach it the difference between when to use the word good and when to use the word well in speech?
No, and you've told me this many times, and I still can't get it. I still can't like lock it in. Now, at what point do we just say language has changed and this is an acceptable?
It's acceptable. My fault, language. Jay.
We'll each get one tonight.
Yeah.
Wait, I'm formally making the word acceptable.
I really like that word.
It's a combination of acceptable and testicle.
It is. That's acceptable. Hey, I know what you're looking at. So anyway, Steve.
Yeah.
Now, remember when we were talking about AI and you're like, look, we're not going to do it. It doesn't. We don't even need it. So
I don't recall that was the conversation.
Well, Steve was saying, like, there's no reason to make it conscious. That's what I mean.
Yeah, he was talking about consciousness.
Yeah, we don't need to make it conscious. So this to me is a way to not have it be conscious, but have it do a lot of things really well.
Yeah, I was going to say that. This is not conscious, this software. Think about it. It could perform in this way, in relational reasoning, really well without being conscious. So I think that supports my point, don't you think?
It does. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I thought about you when I read this. I'm like, you know, this is exactly what Steve was saying. It doesn't need consciousness to have higher thinking.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's also – it's scary how far this is going to go, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Scary, I mean, fun.
Well, right. scary in a good
now,
way.
We can't say that this is the beginning because we've been developing software like this, you know, artificial intelligence-like software for a long time.
It's but a milestone. It's not the beginning, yeah. But we keep crossing these milestones.
Yep.
And they are significant, you know?
Totally agree. Yeah, this is a big one.
This is a good one.
And it's what's fascinating is, like, learning what the milestones are, you know? Mm-hmm. That's what's fascinating. I think that's what's to me, as a neurologist, as a neuroscientist, what's most fascinating about this is thinking about, well, what are those milestones? What kind of processing does human brains do well that we're going to need our computers to do?
Good.
Like relational reasoning. You know, now we understand that process and what it is better because we're trying to duplicate. I think that's, we're going to learn so much about human intelligence from carrying on this process of developing artificial intelligence.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Bob, so at this point in time, how solid a theory is the Big Bang? Is it possible to imagine the universe existing without a Big Bang?
It depends on what you mean by Big Bang. And that's one of the things I encountered doing research for this, is that the nomenclature can be easily confused. So what Steve's referring to is that the Big Bang was in the news this week, and essentially the decades-old theories that are designed to remove the infinities from the Big Bang have been shown not to work. So about the nomenclature, if you're talking about the hot Big Bang model, that thing is bulletproof. That's not going anywhere. That explains our universe incredibly well from, say, a hundredth of a second on afterwards. So that goes over things like the expansion of the universe, the origin of the cosmic background radiation that we've talked about so many times, nucleosynthesis itself, how the light elements are forged are in the early universe, also the formation of galaxies and large scale structure. That's the hot Big Bang model. And that's not going anywhere. That's just way too solid to really have any reasonable doubt. But if you're thinking about the first 100th of a second, that's where things get dicey. That's kind of like the bang part of the Big Bang model. So that part of the universe is basically opaque to us. It's opaque to our theories and our tools. We just are not sure what happened there. And that's because things get wacky at that point in time. Think about it. You go back in time, closer to the actual birth of the universe, energies and densities, energy densities and curvatures goes higher and higher and higher. And at that point in time, it spikes to infinity. So infinities are not fun. Physicists hate infinities, and that's where relativity breaks down. Everything breaks down. Got to create some sort of quantum gravity. We've got to unite general relativity and quantum mechanics to really get a handle on this, and we are just not there yet. That's the crux of this news item. So to resolve this problem, to deal with these infinities, physicists have done different things. One of the things that seemed like a decent idea, decent theories, involved Stephen Hawking and James Hartle's idea of a no-boundary proposal, and this Alexander Vilenkin, his idea of tunneling, quantum tunneling. So those two proposals together, they kind of work together, and they try to do away in the 80s with these infinities, with the Big Bang. So the no-boundary idea, you may have heard this. Hawking has talked about this for quite some time. So the no-boundary proposal treats the universe like it's unbounded. It's like the surface of the Earth. You could travel around it forever. You could walk or fly forever, and you'll never find the edge, at least if you're not a flat earther. It also bizarrely treats the universe as having a beginning and an end in time, but existing forever in imaginary time. So it's really kind of crazy stuff, but fascinating. Check it out. The tunneling proposal kind of describes the universe essentially tunneling out of nothing, which would give the universe a very large curvature, but not an infinite curvature. So those two things taken together help deal with these infinities. So the hope was that this alternative view would preserve the hot Big Bang model, but the Big Bang part would produce an early universe that was smooth with no boundary that tunneled out of quantum nothingness. No more pesky infinity. So that's kind of what the idea was here. And that's where it rested, essentially, from the 80s until, of course, very recently. Some really, really smart people at the Max Planck Institute of Gravitational Physics and the Perimeter Institute as well, they looked at these theories in a very mathematically precise way. So by that, I mean that they can now, with these advanced techniques, they can now finally properly defined the theory mathematically, which lets them then look at what the ramifications of the theories would be if they were true. So they could say, okay, let's assume this is true here. What would the implications be? And this is exactly what they did. They discovered that they don't necessarily, that these theories, these two new theories, these two new proposals, they don't necessarily imply a big, beautiful universe that we live in. They had problems. By using the Heisenberg uncertainty relation, they showed that the no boundary and the tunneling proposals mean that the smooth universes can appear, and that's nice, but the more irregular and weirdly shaped the universe is, the more likely it is to pop up. So that's kind of like a theory killer in a lot of ways. So the overwhelming likelihood then is not a nice smooth universe that would continue expanding for billions of years, but lots of these tiny curved universes that would pop out of seemingly nothing, but then collapse before anything interesting even had a chance to happen. In fact, they would collapse pretty much immediately. So the bottom line then is that these proposals that have been around since the 80s to do away with the infinities of the Big Bang, the bang part of the Big Bang, they don't work. They don't look like they can work and get rid of these infinities. So for now, we are stuck with the Big Bang theory, and all the wonderful infinities that come along with it for now. And so that's where we are. So that's a kind of a big deal, because these no boundary conditions and quantum tunneling have been around for quite some time with regards to the Big Bang, and they don't seem like they're going to cut it as they stand, as the theories stand right now. So there we are.
In a way, it's a good thing that the scientific method sort of is on display in this sense for us all to see, and they've eliminated now, it seems, these possibilities, and I suppose the theorists can start turning their attention to some other models.
Yeah, I hope we all live to see the day when they have a really solid understanding of quantum gravity, that we could really start answering some of these questions. And who knows, maybe if we get a handle on gravitational wave detection, the types of gravitational waves that could illuminate what happened at this instant the universe was born, that could also kind of give us some clues. Because right now, you know, you can't see anything because of photon decoupling. You know, that whole era for hundreds of thousands of years at the beginning of the universe are shrouded. You can't, with a telescope, you're not going to see it. Only gravitational astronomy can peer through that veil. And we're getting to the point where we can potentially do that in the near future. So that would be another great advance. Oh my God, that'd be fantastic.
And the bottom line is that the Big Bang theory, as it stands, doesn't completely work. We know we need some other element.
What do you mean when you say element, Steve? What do you mean? Like we're missing a concept behind it?
Yeah, like you know, the no boundary condition. There's something else that we need to invoke in order to make these infinities disappear.
Well, I mean, but couldn't that something just be quantum gravity? I mean, a fleshed out, you know, unification of relativity and quantum mechanics. I mean, sure.
But we don't have it now.
Right. That's the key. That's you don't need to go any further than that. That's what we need. Quantum gravity. But once we have that.
We won't know until we get it, though.
Right.
Okay, Evan, we're going to go to the other end of the spectrum here and talk about some rank pseudoscience. Breatharians. This is among the stupidest things in the world.
Next to flat earthers, yeah.
Yeah, I think flat earthers might be actually worse.
I mean, how many people have died as a result of flat earth theory? I don't know.
Just that guy who sailed off the
edge. But he proved his point.
Oh, no.
Breatharians, unfortunately, they have a head count associated with them.
I thought it was pronounced breatharians.
Yeah, that's how I would have pronounced it.
Yeah, I think that's how I've heard people say it in the press. Like when they're like, I'm a breatharian. I only eat air.
Well, that's part of the problem is that from only consuming air, they've run into this mispronunciation problem.
I see.
They should just call themselves Air Aryans.
Oh, yeah. Or how about Aryans? That works, right?
No.
Take it.
I didn't even think of that. That's awesome. God.
Well, as far as the news item this week, a lot of the listeners here probably have come across it. I know it hit about a dozen or so of my aggregates. So I imagine people are going to be familiar with this. Now, the folks' names here are Akahi Ricardo and Camila Castello. They call themselves Breatharians, and they claim that they survive primarily on energy that exists in the universe and in themselves.
In the form of hamburgers.
that's the Randy part, which they claim that they've forgotten what it feels like to be hungry. Here's a couple of nice quotes from them. Camila says that humans can easily be without food as long as they are connected to the energy that exists in all things and through breathing. Well, I admit that breathing is very important. The whole exists in the energy of all things sounds a little bit like Jedi lore. She says, for 3 years, Akahi and I didn't eat anything at all, and now we only eat occasionally, like if we're in a social situation or if I simply want to taste a fruit. It's about understanding cosmic nourishment, not just physical nourishment.
Cosmic nourishment.
And living without limits. So they had started their path towards this as vegetarians. They turned into raw vegans, then to something called fruitarians, which I think I figured out quickly what that is. And then finally, breatharians. Oh, yeah. Dangerous is right. It's proven to actually be, in certain cases, a deadly mixture of pseudoscience and cultish behavior. So breatharianism has been linked to the deaths of several people. One example from 1999, Verity Lynn, a 49-year-old Australian whose emaciated body was found on a mountain in northwest Scotland, alongside a diary recounting her 21-day fast and a copy of a book by the founder of breatharianism known as Jasmuheen. Yeah. Mm. So she's an interesting character. I suppose she's perhaps the face of breatharianism these days. Her real name is Ellen Grieve. She's an Australian former financial advisor. And she says we can get all the nutrients we need from prana, which is the universal life force. Right. She claims she hasn't eaten since 1993, although she admits she drinks herbal teas and confesses to the occasional taste orgasm involving chocolate or ice cream.
Mm-hmm. What?
Yeah. So it might be a piece of chocolate. It might be a mouthful of cheesecake, something like that. Right. And several interviewers have found her house full of food. She claims the food is for her husband. And, you know, apparently he's not into the whole breatharian thing, but she is. Now, here's listen to this. She has apparently over 5,000 followers worldwide, and people pay a couple grand, over 2,000 bucks to attend her seminars, in which she tells people about things like this, that her diet is possibly changing her chromosomes. She said a person on the breatharian regime their DNA will change to take up more hydrogen and is developing from 2 to 12 strands.
Would that be a duodecahelix? What would that be? What would 12 helices 12 be?
12-stranded DNA?
Yeah, I mean, literally, if that were the case, she would be like the alien. She would not look human anymore.
Right.
If that were the case, she would be a marvel of modern science, and everybody would be fighting to study her.
Yep. Mm-hmm. When she was confronted about that specific claim, she said, I wasn't talking about myself. I just meant there are other people who are that. You know, that, you know, it was her way of getting out of things like the James Randi Million Dollar Challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. Being able to I didn't mean no food. I was just hyperbole. It's been very little food.
Right. And that's the other part of all this is that they do have food is what really is going on. They say it's minimal, very minimal. It's obviously enough to keep them alive and keep them going. So it's not that minimal per se. And frankly, they've been found almost, I think, on every occasion to be cheating at some point. Like the time James Randi was investigating a guru of some sort who also claimed that, you know, he did not need any food or water to sustain himself. And then one night Randy just, I think, followed him or saw him leave the hotel. So Randy followed him. He went across the street to the Burger King and came back to the hotel. And Randy confronted him in like the parking lot saying, "Hey, what are you doing there?"
Basically, totally. That guy's reaction. Oh,
no, he said, "I just want to smell it."
No, he didn't. Yes, he didn't.
So this is the kind of fraud that is inherent in things like the Breatharian movement. You know,
are all the Breatharians like super, super, super like anorexic skinny?
No.
Well,
they look quite healthy.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't. I wouldn't say anorexic, right, Steve? Although I imagine there are some cases in which some people...
There must be cases of anorexia.
Who have tried this. And it's been studied. It's been looked at. Experts, although they don't have... They can't put a number exactly on how much time you can continue to survive without food or water. It depends on your environment. There are other external factors. Broad consensus seems to rest somewhere between 7 and 10 days.
Water is days.
Yeah,
water's 3 days.
And they said in some cases, depending on where you are on the planet, hours. You can't go a day. You can't go a day without surviving with no water. Drinking.
Yeah, like in equatorial places, that's probably true.
Yeah, so this to me, the whole thing seems utterly ridiculous because first, anybody can conduct a test to prove them wrong. It is the easiest thing to prove wrong as long as they'll comply to one protocol. Do not leave this room for 5 days or 3 days. You know, and the other thing too, that there's lots of different ways that you could utterly debunk this if the people are willing to be tested. First, if they're not eating and they're perfectly healthy, do these people have bowel movements? And would they have bowel movements if they're consuming no calories? I think the answer would be no. They shouldn't really.
So you're consuming no calories, then no.
Makes sense.
Yeah, well, right.
Maybe they would crap photons.
Or rainbows.
They're right? They're shit rainbows. No. Yeah.
That's a cool waste product. Jay, Jasmuheen tried it once as means of proof that it does work. And it was observed by a real doctor about this this fast that she went on. She made it to, I think, the fourth day, and she started to show medical signs that, she was starting to break down. Pupils became dilated. Her speech was slow, certainly dehydration, and her pulse had doubled, and they feared kidney damage. So they decided, we're shutting this down. We're not going to be part of this test anymore.
They shut it down before her kidney shut down.
And here's what you want to hear, the special pleading she invoked afterwards. Okay, so she said that she failed because on the first day of the test, she had been confined in a hotel room near a busy road, which kept her from getting the nutrients she needed from the air. She said, "I asked for fresh air. 70% of my nutrients come from fresh air. I couldn't even breathe." Yeah.
Wait, where did the other 30% come from?
Light, I suppose. And but observers said that the last 3 days of the test took place at a mountainside retreat where she could get plenty of fresh air and where she claimed she lives relatively happily. So, special pleading as always when they exactly. So, 4 days, 4 days of the test. The first day, she was in a hotel room, but the remaining day she was basically in nature, in the wilderness, essentially.
Yep.
Mountainside retreat. So much for that.
Reminds me of the yogic flying, like they're just hopping, you know.
Bouncing on the
bed. But they convince them they're flying. Yeah. So they're like, "Oh, I'm like mostly surviving on air. I still have the occasional hamburger, but it's just for flavor."
Yeah, only once or twice a day.
Right, so I can smell it.
Isn't the quote unquote Barbie doll woman a Breatharian? The woman with like obvious severe mental illness who has had like
100 plastic surgeries?
Tons of plastic surgeries to make herself look like a Barbie doll?
I don't know. I'm never brave enough to actually click on those links because I'm afraid I'll see too many pictures.
Creepy. I think she claims to be, Valeria Lukyanova claims to be a Breatharian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and unfortunately, a lot of the criticism that revolves around this particular news item this week is that every few years these stories do come up and the media really does fail to put it in the proper perspective that this is absolute 100% nonsense from the get-go, not even giving it some kind of equal or fair share time of being anything legitimate. It deserves zero. Attention other than to say how, fraudulent and dangerous it is.
I agree. All right, we got a trio of pseudosciences here. We're starting with breatharians, and now I'm going to talk briefly about biodynamic farming. Have any of you guys ever heard of this before?
Sounds legit.
It's like organic farming, but worse.
That's not good.
In fact, this was like the modern organic farming movement actually started with biodynamic farming. It was like the first of the modern organic farming movements. So it's basically if you combined astrology, homeopathy, herbalism, sympathetic magic, and organic farming, that's what you would have biodynamic farming. So they do things like planting according to the astrological signs, like under a certain phase of the moon when the moon is in Venus or whatever, you have to plant this way. They also do a lot of like, they take a cow horn. There's lots of like, you take parts of a cow and then you put stuff in it and you bury it for a season or two and then you take it out and spread it on your field. Right. So they like horse, you take cow manure, you put it in a cow horn, you bury it for the winter, and then come spring, you have fermented manure and that little handful of fermented manure is supposed to like save your whole farm. So it's complete. It's complete nonsense, but apparently that this is what the news bit that, you know, I read an article that it's on the increase, like increased over 15% last year, because organic farming isn't a waste enough of money. People want to waste money even more. Like, I think organic farming, it is completely unsustainable, although it sells itself as quote unquote sustainable farming. Like a lot of pseudosciences, there's often like this patina of either incidental legitimacy or fake legitimacy. You know, it's like naturopaths will give you some actual exercise and basic common sense dieting advice. That's not what naturopathy is about. It's not unique to them. It's not new to them, but they sort of incorporate that to say that they're legitimate because we give real advice. Or you could get exercise doing yoga. You know what I mean? There's often massages are fine, you know, even though you're not actually squeezing out toxins. And so this is the same thing. It's like they may actually do some, you know, practices which are good for the soil or whatever, but it doesn't matter because their very concept is based on pseudoscience. The notion is that the farm has to be the self-sustaining ecosystem unto itself. So they try to minimize off-farm inputs. The problem is, of course, that that's the opposite of what farms are for. You know, the whole point of farms is to export nutrients, right? And if you're going to export nutrients, you have to import inputs, right? You have to import the nitrogen. So this kind of totally internal farming is fine for subsistence farming. Like if you just want to feed yourself, sure. But it's not, you know, we don't have the land to use for this. And in fact, in the interview in the article that was promoting it, it said, the farmer that they interviewed said, I'm not trying to feed the world. I'm just trying to feed my neighbors. It's like, yeah, that's the point. You're using up all this land to feed you and your very, very, you know, few people. You know, as I know we've said on the show before, half the earth is already used for farming and pretty much out of farmable land. So this kind of boutique, premium, self-indulgent kind of farming, which is mostly pseudoscience, is not really a good use of land.
It's several steps backwards, frankly, is what it sounds like.
Yeah. So anyway, but unfortunately, it's on the rise. It should be going away. I do wonder at some point, if, you know, as populations increase, we just can't do this. You know what I mean? We just cannot use arable land for nonsense. We talked about the fact that, you know, how much land is being used to grow non-foodstuffs like opium and tobacco, you know, and how much of it is being wasted by farming that's massively inefficient for an upscale market of people who are overfed, you know. That can't last forever.
Yeah, I wonder if there'll come a point where there's like, you know, eminent domain.
Yeah.
It's like, sorry, you can't do this anymore. We gotta like farm food efficiently on this property. So bye bye.
Maybe.
I mean, I hope it doesn't get to that point. I hope we level off but you know, it will get to this point unless there is a leveling off.
How's climate change impacting the amount of farmland that's available to us? I imagine it's having negative consequences.
Well, it's mixed. The higher CO2 does increase plant growth to some extent because, you know, plants breathe CO2. Right. But it is shifting optimal growing land, which isn't good. again, a lot of times, like the global warming deniers will say, oh, there's no one climate that's the best or the right one for the Earth. It's changing all the time. It's like, yeah, it's true. But we sort of built our civilization around the current climate, and having it rapidly change is a little inconvenient, you know?
Just a little.
And yeah, so one thing that one of the piece of that is that farmland can shift to, you know, away from the equator, and it may not be to the most arable land, you know, or you know, to land that's optimal for farming. And you know, imagine if just like the breadbasket,
yeah,
if we lose it, yeah, if we lose it because it's a, you know, where the growing cycle decreases or whatever, you know, the growing season shortens, could have a huge impact. And plants are not necessarily optimized to take maximal advantage of the increased CO2 to offset it. That's another thing that's, you know, that some people are working on that with genetic modification to try to, we can partly offset that if we optimize some crops to take maximal advantage of the higher CO2. But right now they don't. Just, it creates a lot of unknowns. And again, it's not like there's land that we could move into because we're basically using all the farmable land. So,
yes, land is a zero-sum game for the most part.
And if we lose land to oceans rising, you know, there might not be enough to feed the world.
Sure. All these things add up.
But I see pseudoscience is like this as partly it's just a massive inefficiency and partly it's like a parasite on civilization. You know what I mean? Just sucking away resources. It's not really doing anything. It's mainly just catering to ideology or self-indulgent upscale people, faking them out with pseudoscience, claims that aren't true, like it's healthier or better for the environment, neither of which are true.
I mean, don't you think, though, that when push comes to shove and there really is a much more aggressive supply and demand issue, this problem will be even smaller than it is now? I mean, the truth is it's a tiny percentage of actual farming is done this way.
Well, that's because by definition, mm-hmm. traditional farming is on a huge scale, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And you can't do organic farming on that scale. But the organic farmers advocates say that you can, but they're just making it up. They really can't. You have to crunch. When you crunch the numbers, you realize, no, where are you going to get the nitrogen from? You have to think about things. So in a way, what we need to do, because they're thinking like, oh, we have to treat the farm like an ecosystem. No, actually, we need to treat the planet like an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. We have to think about where the nitrogen and the carbon and the water and everything is coming from and going on a worldwide level, because that's our civilization, right? It's a world-spanning civilization. You can't just look at your one tiny little farm. That's not really the perspective that we need. And the notion that you can, like, because the farmer says, we just need everyone to be doing this. No, we can't have everybody doing this. By definition, it just won't work. You can't just scale up what you're doing at that tiny scale.
No, you can't. I mean, there are interesting workarounds that use science, you know, these closed farming systems, these vertical farming systems,
massively
indoor farming systems.
They're massively
inefficient. Unless individuals want to start growing their own food, which you just can't expect everybody to do that. It's like a rich people problem.
Yeah. That's the other thing. Do we really want to go back to a time when 30% of the workforce were working on farms? Is that supposed
Serfdom.
To be a good
no.
thing?
Serfdom. No, not at all. I mean, I want to have a little garden, right? We're doing an exterior renovation. I'm really excited about having a raised garden, but that doesn't mean I'm going to grow everything I eat. It means I'm going to grow the things that I can figure out how to grow without killing them.
I have a garden every summer. It's fun. You grow food. You get fresh food. You know, vegetables and stuff. It's great.
Yeah.
But it's a tiny percentage of my calories that
you know, exactly.
If you had to grow all your food.
Well, imagine if you had to keep your own cows.
Yeah. It's just, it's untenable. You can't do it.
Yeah.
I have better things to do than just growing my own food. That's the thing. I mean, you know, we're going to massively, the fact that so few people can grow enough food to feed everybody is actually one of the great efficiencies of our modern civilization. So it frees up so many people to do other stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just watching a show talking about, you know, automated farming and the levels of automation. And they're saying they're pretty much at the point where one person can farm like 10,000 acres. One person can do
a lot of robots.
One person can oversee that and control the whole process, and they're quickly getting to the point where you just won't need hardly anybody.
All right, one more pseudoscience. Kara, you're going to tell us about coconut oil.
This is a great story. Okay, I don't know why I'm especially excited about this in a sort of like Schadenfreude kind of way, which I feel really bad about saying. But so many people out here where I live in LA are like, cuckoo bananas for coconut oil. They think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. They think that it's so healthy. And the truth is that a lot of people think that, apparently. A survey reported that 72% of the American public rated coconut oil as a, quote, healthy food. 72%. Well, you want to know why coconut oil is not very good for you?
It's because oil?
It's basically pure saturated fat.
Fat.
Well, there are oils that are way better for you than coconut oil. And it really comes down to the level of saturated fat that's contained within that oil and what it actually does to your LDL, which is a, you know, quote unquote bad cholesterol.
Low density protein.
Yeah, I try to avoid using those kinds of terms. Not the one that you just used, Bob. That's appropriate. Low density lipoprotein.
That's how it's commonly referred to.
But yeah, we commonly refer to that as, quote, bad cholesterol. It's really bad in the sense that if it is too high and your HDL is too low, that's problematic. And also high LDL has been linked statistically to a hardening of the arteries and an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. We know this, though. We know that having high levels of LDL, having low levels of HDL, are related to, I think I have to word it that, are highly correlated with cardiovascular risk. This is not anything that's new. But what is new is that the American Heart Association put out a presidential advisory called Dietary Fats and Cardiovascular Disease. It was actually just published on June 15th, 2017. And it's a really, really intensive, long report that's all based on pretty solid science. You know, they tried to look for the highest quality studies that they could. They tried to look at the newest scientific evidence available. And here's a good pull from the abstract. In summary, randomized controlled trials that lowered intake of dietary saturated fat and replaced it with polyunsaturated vegetable oil reduced CVD, which is cardiovascular disease, by about 30%, similar to the reduction achieved by statin treatment.
Wow.
So, yeah, taking statins to lower cholesterol and in effect, try and improve your cardiovascular health or try and, I guess, reduce your cardiovascular disease. It works just as well to just eat better. Just eat a little bit better. And so when
depends on your genetics,
oil,
though, Carrie. Don't shame people for taking medication if you need it. If you have
certain
genetics
not.
Or if diet's not enough, some people, you know.
Yeah, of course. And I know many, many people who take statins. My parents take statins, yeah. And it's life-saving for them. But what I am saying is that if you are eating high levels of saturated fat, you
it's
could have as much of an improvement if you switch those over to polyunsaturated fats. And so let's look. Within the study, they actually did include a pretty handy dandy table. Here it is, that shows the fatty acid composition of fats and oils. And here's something interesting that I was like pretty unaware of this. If you look at the saturated fats within saturated fat in grams per 100 grams of these different oils, canola oil, for example, has 7 grams of saturated fat, 63 grams of monounsaturated fat, and 28 grams of polyunsaturated fat. Okay, so 7 grams of saturated fat in canola oil. What's another one we often use? Olive oil, 14 grams of saturated fat. Lard, 39 grams of saturated fat.
Lard.
Butter, 63 grams of saturated fat.
Oh, gosh, that's what
tallow, so beef oil, just cooking in like beef tallow, 50 grams of saturated fat. Coconut oil, 82 grams of saturated fat.
See,
coconut oil and palm kernel oil have the highest rates of saturated fat of any of the oils that are basically on the market. And their polyunsaturated fat in coconut oil, 2 grams. Mm-hmm. 2 grams of polyunsaturated, so it's 82 terrible. Grams. It's so high in these dangerous fats. It's just the one of the most dense things you could possibly eat. And that does translate to these LDLs, these basically these lipids or lipoproteins in your bloodstream. You're just increasing the level of them that you would find there. So here's a little bit more directly from the study, because they looked at a lot of new trials and pointed out a lot of pretty interesting things. So there was a study between coconut oil and vegetable oils high in monounsaturated fats and polyunsaturated fats. So let's say they looked at individuals who were eating coconut oil versus individuals who had the same intake as canola oil. So they also looked at the effects of butter and safflower oil. Butter and coconut oil raised LDL cholesterol compared with safflower oil. Butter did it more than coconut oil, but coconut oil still raised it significantly. And those who took vegetable oils high in monounsaturated fats versus those who took coconut oil did not see an increase in their LDL cholesterol. And remember, we're talking about LDL, 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 because you may have read some more recent reports, those of you who follow the kind of nutrition literature, showing that it's not a really good idea anymore to link HDL to cardiovascular disease. If you specifically just look at HDL on its own, it's not a very good predictor of much. But looking at LDL still holds that strong correlation. And then also looking at the relationship between your HDL and your LDL. So coconut oil raised, okay. A recent systematic view found 7 controlled trials, including those 2 that I just talked about, that compared coconut oil with monounsaturated or polyunsaturated oil. So some of them were vegetable oils and some of them were in other areas. Coconut oil raised LDL cholesterol in all 7 of these trials, and it did so significantly in 6 of them. And they did not find a significant difference between raising of LDL in subjects who took coconut oil versus butter, beef fat, or palm oil. So basically anything that had a very high saturated fat content seemed to raise LDL, whereas those with lower saturated fat and higher monounsaturated fats did not. And so here is basically the crux of the coconut oil portion of this American Heart Association report. Quote, because coconut oil increases LDL cholesterol, a cause of CVD, and has no known offsetting favorable effects, we advise against the use of coconut oil. So the American Heart Association, point blank, is saying you should not eat coconut oil. It's not healthy.
Yeah, so I think you're right, Carrie. I think there's 2 basic pathways to how do we get to the point where the coconut oil is a fat health fad when the evidence mm-hmm. shows that it's horrible for you. One is gurus extrapolating from basic science, and they don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand the relationship between basic science and clinical science, and they're just mm-hmm. looking for shit to say. So that's one. But 2 is much more cynical, and we know this happens as well, is that some marketer gets a supply of something. It doesn't matter what it is. They corner the market, or they figure out some company Bangladesh somewhere can sell me this purple thing or whatever. It doesn't matter what it is. They secure the supply, and then they promote it as a health food because they already have the supply of it. They've cornered the market on it. And then they just start getting people to say that it's the latest health fad.
And it's interesting how that just snowballs. Like, certain things take off and certain things don't. Mm-hmm. But I think coconut oil is a good example of one that, I mean, at least out here in LA, every health food store sells it by the vat. And people are cooking all their food in it. They're using it in their salad dressing. They're using it as the emulsifier for almost everything they cook. And they use it as moisturizer and hair conditioner. And they're mm-hmm. putting it all over their bodies. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, I'm not saying that it works. I think it has moisturizing. It's oil. So, of course, it has moisturizing properties. It's not dangerous to put coconut oil in your hair or to rub it on your arms unless you have an allergy. So, fine. If that's a cheaper, easier substitute for you, or you like the way it smells or whatever, that's great. But putting it in your body, thinking that it's going to have some sort of magical benefit.
And
no.
What galls me, it's really surprising. I guess not surprising, but I'm not a nutritionist, but if I was going to evaluate a cooking oil, the first mm-hmm. thing, the first thing I look at, well, what are the saturated fats look like? And that, mm-hmm. that's it. You don't need to go much farther than that. As soon as you see that that's off the hook, you're like, whoa, of course I'm not going to eat that. Look how high the saturated fats are.
Okay. Well, thanks, Kara. We're going to do one email this week. This is actually a series of emails that is a follow-up to a topic that I talked about last week because I made a mistake in discussing the human metabolism. So just as background, I want to point out that a lot of when the technical things like this sometimes come up on the show and they're unscripted, like we didn't prepare for them. And we either have to do like some fact-checking while we're recording, and sometimes we do that. Sometimes I do it in post-production. I actually spend a lot of time, you know, on Saturday morning when I'm post-producing the show. Like if I hear any fact that I am not certain of, I'll look it up right then and there. And you may hear me break in with, even though as much as I try to make it sound the same, you could tell when I'm doing the ADR, you know, the adding the audio after the fact. But this last week, there was, you know, some unexpected technical details came up. I was winging it on my memory, meant to fact check it. And then my daughter was graduating on Saturday, and I was rushed in doing post-production on the show.
Damn her.
Well, I can't believe she finished high school.
She was supposed to graduate on Friday, so get this.
Yeah, what the hell?
This is a side story. So she was supposed to graduate on Friday, and then the weather forecast was for rain, and the principal wouldn't just commit to either having it indoors or delaying it, you know, to a different time, and we were literally getting like these hourly updates. Then I hear like
what?
The mayor's daughter was graduating, and that was there was some politics involved with that, and it was just this craziness. Like they wouldn't commit. So I'm here like, I need to know when I need to do my post-production on the show. So I have to go to, you know, Saturday morning to her graduation. They ended up moving it to Saturday morning outside, and it was fine.
Beautiful.
But the mayor couldn't be there because I guess that's what they were trying to avoid, is like the mayor having to miss the thing. But whatever. So anyway, so I'm scrambling at the last minute to get the show done. And I actually had to send everybody on ahead without me. And I was like, just showed up in time for the graduation. So anyway, that's not really an excuse. I'm just saying that's what happened. So
we can't know everything off the top of our heads.
I know, but I do honestly have a process to try to make sure these things minimize the mistakes that slip through. And then when they do, we'll just fix it. So we were talking about the fasting exercise and gluconeogenesis and all that stuff. So rather than going through what I said wrong, let me just say the real information. Okay, so for a little bit of background, we can store calories as calories in the form of adipose tissue, right? So the three macronutrients, like our fatty acids, protein, and glucose, if we can store extra fatty acids as adipose tissue. We can, if we have more glucose than we eat at the moment, we store that as glycogen in the liver. We can't really store extra protein. You have the protein in your muscles in your body, but there's no place where we store up extra protein, right? But
do we have circulating amino acids or anything like
that?
Yeah,
well, yeah, but that's very insignificant.
But that's just what's usable right then. Yeah.
It's very volatile, Kara. It's not. There's no store. There's no store of protein other than your actual muscles, right? But fat is stored calories. Glycogen is stored glucose. So when you eat and your blood sugar rises, you shift into glycogen storage to get your blood, sugar down. Blood sugar, you know, glucose goes into the cells. That's what the insulin does. And you use the sugar for calories, for energy as an energy source. It's been a while since you've eaten, your blood sugar drops, you convert glycogen to glucose, right? So if all goes well, you could maintain a fairly steady blood level of glucose using the glycogen in your liver as a buffer. Now, there's two basic tissues in the body that need glucose, the brain and blood cells. So the energy you can get, the metabolism you can get from glucose is a lot faster. You can get a lot more energy from glucose than you can from fatty acids. But you can burn fatty acids directly for fuel. So actually the triglycerides in your fat gets broken down into fatty acids and glycerol, which you could feed into, you know, the energy cycle, and you can make energy from them. Great. When you're burning fat for energy, that is producing a lower metabolic rate of energy than glucose, and your brain can't use fat. Your brain has to use glucose. Yeah, your brain needs sugar. That's why, you know, we store glucose as glycogen, mainly so that your brain always has a constant supply of glucose. So what happens when you run out of glycogen in your liver and your blood sugars are running low and your brain needs glucose? Your body could, your other metabolism can use the fat, but your brain needs glucose. Well, that's where gluconeogenesis comes in. So, mammals can undergo what's called gluconeogenesis, where they reverse the breaking down of glucose into pyruvate and then other things for energy. Although it's a very inefficient process, meaning it uses a lot of energy to do that. Obviously you have to put the energy in that you're getting out of it in the first place, right? But obviously, second law of thermodynamics, you can't get as much energy out when you reverse the process, so the whole thing is a waste. But we do it because your brain needs glucose.
Yeah, we do it so we don't die.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. We can make glucose out of amino acids. You make glucose out of protein, basically. We cannot make, and this is what I was thinking of when I got confused, but anyway, we cannot make glucose out of fat. So we either burn fat directly, we burn glucose directly. We could actually get energy out of amino acids, but we also can turn amino acids into glucose through gluconeogenesis as an emergency measure so that our brain has glucose. Now there's also ketones, and ketones can be made out of either amino acids or fatty acids. So either protein or fat can be made into ketones, and ketones also can be used for energy. And that's sort of the emergency sort of energy supply when you can't even make glucose.
And that's what people on like paleo diets intentionally
go
into ketosis.
There's no evidence that it's beneficial. You know, maybe.
Yeah, I don't think it's that bad for you unless you're diabetic, right? Or not unless you're diabetic. There's a threshold after which it's deadly.
Yes, and that threshold is called ketoacidosis. So ketones are acidic. And a little bit of ketosis is fine physiologically. Again, my reading of the literature is there's no long-term or sustainable advantage to it.
Because I think it happens just randomly, too. Like, we just have times when we don't have enough sugar.
Yeah, you're going to make some ketones. Fine. It's like another little safety valve. But if you're so starved, or if you're diabetic and you can't, this is why diabetics said it, because they can't get sugar. They have glucose, but they can't get it into their cells because the insulin, they're either not making insulin or they're insulin resistant. So the glucose levels are high in their blood, but their cells are simultaneously starved for glucose. So then they have to make ketones for energy. And then when you get past a certain point, you get ketoacidosis. It overwhelms your body's ability to buffer the pH of your blood. And then that's really dangerous. Ketoacidosis puts you in a coma, could potentially be fatal. That's really dangerous.
Yeah, that's like when you hear people who went into diabetic coma, that's what was happening.
They were in ketoacidosis. That's exactly right. All right. So the other thing that I brought up and got wrong was hibernation. So clearly animals that hibernate, you know, have some skills that animals that don't hibernate have, because they have to be able to go, like a bear could go for 9 months
without, they have brown fat,
without eating. Well, it's more this. So yes, there are differences in the fat, but we have brown fat too, but they have different percentages.
But they have lots.
They have more brown fat. But here's the thing. So first they turn their brain activity way down so that their brain doesn't need a lot of glucose.
And they're also cold, right? Their physical core body temperature.
They bring down their body. They bring down all of their metabolism. So they go into a minimal metabolism state. And a slow use of energy, you can just survive on fat. So they could go for 9 months on fat. They still need some glucose, and they do undergo some gluconeogenesis, and they will also waste muscle over their hibernation because they need to have some glucose. So once they go through their glycogen stores, they start burning, you know, muscle for gluconeogenesis. They also can get enough water out of their fat stores that they could survive on that. They don't have to drink for months. So they don't pee. They also recycle their urea.
Cool.
Yeah. So they recycle their urea. They basically recycle all their fluid. They have minimal loss of water. They get most of their energy from fat and some from muscle, and they can go freaking 9 months without eating.
Wow.
Yeah, but no mammals can make glucose from fat. Although I did read, a couple of studies saying maybe it's theoretically possible. They essentially showed that there is a potential metabolic pathway by which you can get to glucose from fatty acids, but no one has shown that it's actually happening in mammals or in people specifically. And if it did, it was probably in very tiny amounts. And again, it would be very inefficient because there's this long, you know, alternate metabolic pathway you would have to take. And it's only theoretical at this point. So basically, you know, the bottom line is at this point in time, there's no, either none at all or no significant gluconeogenesis from fatty acids. It's only from amino acids, which again is why you don't want to fast, right? Because you don't want to burn muscle. You want it, ideally, you would have a nice little steady state of glucose for your brain, a nice, you know, steady state of calorie burning, and you're burning through your fatty acids for energy if you're trying to lose weight, or you're just at homeostasis if you're trying to maintain your weight. The idea that you're going to deliberately, you know, use up your glucose stores and have to rely on, you know, burning amino acids or whatever is just nonsense. There's no advantage to that in terms of your net loss of calories. Yeah. If you're trying to optimize your exercise, when you do have time to exercise, you're trying to optimize it. You want to be healthy. You want to build muscle. You want to have endurance. You want everything, you want to feel good. You want everything to function well. You want to be hydrated. You want to have glucose for fuel. You want to be optimal, right? You want that engine to be working. You don't want to be stressing it out and being on your emergency reserves. It doesn't make any sense. All right, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Just three news items this week, no theme. You guys ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Bob is.
All right. Item number one, a new analysis of the English language over 1,000 years finds that word use changes in unpredictable ways and is strongly influenced by high-profile individuals. Item number two, a new study finds that American 19-year-olds are as sedentary as 60-year-olds. And item number three, a survey of 2,000 exoplanets finds a distinct gap in the size of worlds from 1.75 to 2.0 times the size of Earth for as yet unknown reasons. Bob, was that you clearing your throat? I was going to make you go first this week anyway, Bob. Go ahead.
Yeah, the throat clearing.
Dooms you every time.
So they looked at the English language over 1,000 years. Word use changes in unpredictable ways. Strongly influenced by high-profile individuals. Sure, I mean, what the hell? I mean, who would disagree with that? It wouldn't surprise me if it was like, if it wasn't high-profile people. Both, I kind of construct an argument in my head for either one. So let's go to the next one here. American 19-year-olds as sedentary as 60-year-olds. I totally buy that. I mean, that's one of the things I've been reading for years about just how sedentary kids are compared to previous generations. So that I'm totally buying that. Third one now, we've got 2,000 exoplanets finds a distinct gap in the size of worlds from 1.75 to 2 times the size of Earth for a shit. What? That's the gap between 1.75 and 2.0? Like they're not finding exoplanets that are 1.85? That's the gap?
That's correct.
Yeah, that just seems like too arbitrary. And yeah, so I'll say the exoplanets fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Okay, English language. 1,000 years? That is interesting. Strongly influenced by high-profile individuals. I don't know about that. It's like a top-down design, in a sense. You're sort of arguing in a certain way here, and I would think it's more disorganized ground up.
I could see somebody, you know, making a new phrase like, you know, prime the pump, and everyone starts saying it, you know.
Good one, Bob. I wonder if we're going to get that reference when we listen back to the show 5 years from now.
Probably not.
Yes, we will.
Let's hope we do. The second one, the study finds American 19-year-olds are as sedentary as 60-year-olds. Wow, this is terrible. But in a sad way, I have a feeling this one's going to be right. And then the last one, the survey of 2,000 exoplanets. A gap? There's a gap. Gee whiz, I don't know. Gee, so it's either that one or it's the language one, gee whiz, I'm leaning towards the language one being the fiction. Again, I think this, how you describe it, Steve, is kind of a top-down formation, where I think rather it's just the opposite. I think it's because of the unpredictable nature, it would be from the ground up. So I'll say that one's the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
The first one about the English language in over 1,000 years, a 1,000-year study, I guess. Interesting. Sure. I mean, I would agree that high-profile individuals, the way that they use language, I mean, by the sheer fact that they're high-profile means that they have exposure, which could easily be a strong, you know, source of influence on people. Why not? That makes a lot of sense. And then the changes are unpredictable. How would you predict the changes in language if it's inherently unpredictable? So that one is science. The second one here is also, I think the second one here is science, that American 19-year-olds are as sedentary as 16-year-olds. I have certainly, through my anecdotal research, witnessed this, which doesn't mean that much to me other than the fact that I believe everything I see, so therefore I'm correct and I've already won and the game is over. No?
Game over, man.
No, I think that this is science as well. I really don't like this third one. I agree with Bob. I think it's kind of weird and arbitrary. You know, it was everything that Bob was saying about, you know, why does that gap exist? And he just thinks, you know, 2,000 exoplanets, everything. I'm not seeing anything here that I'm buying. So that one's the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
The thing that bugs me about the English language one is that I'm not sure. It feels internally invalidated, like internally inconsistent. Like, it seems like a conflict to say that they change in unpredictable ways, yet they are strongly influenced by high-profile individuals. Like, that's a predictable pattern. So, I don't know. That one bugs me, because I feel like, yeah, there's internal problems with the way that's written. And a survey of 2,000 exoplanets finds a distinct gap in the size of worlds from, I mean, I don't know, 1.75 to 2 times. I mean, that's so random. And if so, you know it's a fluke, but it still could happen. 2,000's a big number, but it's not that big compared to all the exoplanets that exist in the universe. I think I have to GWBJ. Sorry, E. I'm going to go with the exoplanets.
All right, so you guys all agree on the middle one, so we'll start there. A new study finds that American 19-year-olds are as sedentary as 60-year-olds. You guys all think this one is science, and this is science.
Yeah.
Boo.
So, yeah, so this is a very big survey, and they used a lot of accelerometer data from smartphones.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And they found that, yeah, man, teenagers are sedentary. 13 to 19-year-olds, bad. So, and over the course of the life, so the only age group in which activity levels increase was the in people after 20, they tend to increase their activity level, and they sort of maintain activity till from 20 to 35. And then after 35, activity level generally peters off. So it's low in kids. It's low as we get past 35. We're only really physically active from 20 to 35.
Oh, crap.
Pretty much
every 2 more years.
Pretty much every age group, though, doesn't get enough physical activity according to, like, the World Health Organization recommendations. So everybody needs to be moving more, walking more.
Yes.
Yeah, especially Americans, perhaps.
It's not certainly not unique to Americans. This is now more of a global phenomenon.
So what is it? Is it the video games?
I'm sure that's playing a role. It's just, yes, you know, it's a lot of draw for screen time, you know. Okay, well, let's go back to number one.
I'm predicting that Steve pulled a trick on us, guys.
A new analysis of the English language over 1,000 years finds that word use changes in unpredictable ways and is strongly influenced by high-profile individuals. Evan, you are standing alone in thinking that this one is the fiction.
Okay.
Everyone else thinks this one is science. Kara, I was interested by your interpretation, but what if an individual is introducing a quirky change to the language, wouldn't that be inherently unpredictable?
It would be unpredictable depending on, again, how you define predictability. I think that it would be predictable
unpredictable.
It's predictable in the sense that you could probably point to the thought leaders, the individuals who are most likely to influence change. But yeah, you're not going to know what word they introduced.
We all say nuclear now, so.
Right. Yeah, all of us.
It feels
okay,
bad, doesn't it?
So
one of us.
This one is the fiction. Good
it
job.
Is the fiction. Oh my God, he screwed us. I knew it. I knew it.
Dang it.
Wait a second. Which one is the fiction?
The language is the fiction.
The nuclear one.
Right.
Sweet Jesus.
Option.
No, it can't be.
Yes, sure he screwed us. He screwed us, Jay. He knew we read it, and he screwed us.
Did you read it?
Oh, I didn't even
you read it.
It? Oh, that's hilarious.
Because it says right there in the it's the opposite. It's very systematic and predictable. The changes that occur over the long period of time.
I see.
Here's the way in which it is predictable. And Kara, this reminds me so much of like the what's the word segments that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So one pattern that is very common is that word usage starts out as very concrete and then gets progressively abstract and disembodied and internalized.
There you go.
It goes from order to chaos.
So in other words, if you have a word like reflection refers to light bouncing off of reflective surface. That's a very external, concrete, physical concept. And then over time, the word starts to become more abstract. Then we talk about like reflecting on your life. It becomes mm-hmm. more abstract, personal, and internal, right?
Cool.
Or using light to mean physical light or mental light, right?
Well, and a lot of people would argue, a lot of linguists would argue that that's actually how language was formed as well.
Well, yeah.
Like, so we've talked about this,
right? We talked
right?
About disembodied, like, yeah, so embodied yeah, cognition. But the question is, given that there's multiple of these types of patterns in the language, is that that made me question, is embodied cognition really the phenomenon, or is it just the tendency for concrete words to be co-opted for progressively more abstract meanings and metaphors?
Yeah, because that's a more inclusive umbrella.
Yes.
It's just that embodied cognition would fall under that.
It's a
that
special
really
case
beautifully.
Of it.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So maybe it's more of a linguistic phenomenon. But again, how could you really separate linguistic and cognitive phenomena? But
well, yeah, that's what symbolic interactionism yeah. is, right? It's like language is how we know like how right. we have the intellect that we have.
But the directionality they found was very predictable. And there were these multiple, you know, aspects of words that changed predictably over the long period of time.
Can we extrapolate forward and figure out where it's going?
Well, it's hard to say because, you know, it's very necessity driven. So like when technology, like we talked about, you know, volatile, right? When technology comes around, then we have to borrow metaphorical concepts. Like we talk about opening a file and putting it in a folder and, you know, even mm-hmm. the mouse is, you know, a metaphor for a physical thing. So the technology tends to use words that already exist, but just give them a metaphorical, more abstract meaning, which is interesting. So that pattern is very predictable, but obviously it's like evolution has patterns that are predictable, but you don't know exactly what's going to evolve into what over time. It's not that level of predictability. Very cool.
Mm.
And we see that again, Kara, like when we talk about a word that started out as meaning this and then like it started out meaning flying and then it turned mm-hmm. into computer memory, you know, or it turned into, you know, evaporation. How did we get from A to B? It's because it's a metaphor. It's just,
yeah. And those steps along the way, they trend. Obviously, they utilize the metaphor as they trend, but they do trend into a less physical and more kind
exactly.
of ethereal.
Exactly. Yeah. And they call that metaphorical mapping. So linguists do metaphorical mapping to see how words change over time. Very cool.
Very cool.
All of this means that a survey of 2,000 exoplanets finds a distinct gap in the size of worlds from 1.75 to 2 times the size of Earth for as yet unknown reasons is science. So yeah, they did it. Now there's been, we know of over 3,500 exoplanets, but these were 2,000 that they were able to measure in more precisely. So we have a precise data on their size. And there is this distinct gap in this size range. There's a couple of worlds who fall into that gap, but statistically it's a void. And 2000
well, Steve,
is enough.
Wasn't the gap between Earth and super Earths and the mini Jupiters? I mean, that's
yeah,
the gap.
That's the gap. But Earth with super Earths going up to 1.75 times the size of the Earth. And the mini Neptunes pick up at 2 times the Earth. So why is there the gap? That's
two.
Did you read this news item too?
I skimmed it, but I apparently didn't read it close enough.
Yeah. So here's the possible explanations. We don't know why, but here's the hypothesis so far that once a planet gets big enough, it becomes big enough to accumulate hydrogen and helium. And once it can accumulate a little bit, it sort of jumps the gap and gets enshrouded in hydrogen and helium enough to bump it up to like the 2 times the Earth size. Does that make sense? Because it does jump also to the mini Neptunes that are very gaseous. So it'd be very, it's like being on top of a hill, you know, that 1.75 to 2.0 range. It's very unstable. Like a planet would have to have just the right amount of hydrogen in the atmosphere, and it would tend to go one way or the other, you know, to either lose its atmosphere and go down or gain atmosphere and go up, leaving that size range relatively void. Anyway, that's the hypothesis as to why that happens, but statistically it's definitely there. What's good is that the astronomers who are writing in the study saying that the galaxy, the universe, likes to make planets that are Earth-sized. You know, that there's a lot of rocky planets right around the size of Earth.
Yeah.
Mm.
There's another category which are like the mini Neptunes, and then the gas giants, which are like the Jupiter or Saturn-sized worlds going up from there. But it's great that now we have enough data points that we could start to make some statistical statements about what typical planets are like, although still our data is very skewed by our selection bias by the methods we're using to find them.
Absolutely, because most of the planets that we're finding are within the orbit of Mercury, which is like a third of an AU.
Oh,
so
gosh,
it's,
so
to me that it's really skewed because those are the easy ones to find, of course. So, but we're 3 times the distance of the typical exoplanet. So to me, it is a very biased survey, even now with over 4,000 exoplanets.
Right. And it may be biasing the size as well, but I think not so much. The placement, definitely. It's easy for the transit method, you know, it's the closer planets that are easy to find.
Yeah.
Both because of the period as well. Like if you have we would never be able to find a Neptune.
Oh, God.
By the transit method, because it would take literally hundreds of years, you know, to confirm it. But then you could use the wobble of the star. So large planets that are far away will have a gravitational influence on the star. We could detect them that way. And if they're big and far enough out, you could then, you know, obscure the star and actually see the light from the planets. And we found some planets that way as well. But yeah, so I wonder, you know, what it's going to take to like really get thorough surveys of enough solar systems, you know, where we have enough different methods of finding planets that there's no more selection bias. We're finding all of them, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Good job, Evan.
Thanks.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, okay, Ev.
Yeah, great, Evan.
Evan, as a reward, you get to read us the quote.
Ooh, I like that. Most people cherish their memories, but I know from my work just how much fiction is already in there.
Oh, wow.
And that was from an interview with Elizabeth Loftus, American cognitive psychologist and expert on human memory. She's conducted extensive research on the malleability of human memory, best known for her groundbreaking work on the misinformation effect and eyewitness memory, and the creation and nature of false memories, including recovered memories of childhood sexual abuse. She, yeah, again, reminds us of just how terrible our memories are at things. Or what should I say? You know, we like to embellish things, whether willingly or not, very much subconsciously. All kinds of stuff filters, you know, gets in there, and it's tough to suss it out and filter out what really happened and, you know, what's an embellishment.
You can't do it from memory alone. You need external evidence.
You need recorders. You need to keep an audio diary, a podcast or something to remember all the crazy things you said.
Whenever you have the opportunity to test your memory against objective recording of information, it's always terrible. Your memory's always way off, you know? Especially in the details.
Especially in the details, and even in very high-profile events. We've talked about what everyone was doing when, you know, where were you when the space shuttle Challenger exploded?
It's a flashbulb memory.
JFK. Right, flashbulb.
Yeah, they're terrible too.
It's disturbing. When you really let it sink in, you just have to question everything. Like, I have memories where I'm like, I remember remembering that. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, you do have to question everything.
Yeah, it's a shame.
Jay, do you remember that your brain pulsates in your skull?
I was a few nights ago, like that screwed with me for about 10 minutes. I'm lying
in bed.
I'm like, yep, The thing that perceives my reality and remembers everything that I am is wiggling like a worm.
It doesn't more wiggle like a
bowl
worm.
Of jello. Bowl of jello.
No, it pulses jello. With your yeah. pulse.
Oh. Pulsating jello.
If I took it out of your skull and put it on the table, it would yeah. quiver like
then
jello.
Then it would be like yeah. jello. Right.
When it's
yeah.
alive and it's getting a blood source, it's wriggling like a worm in the jungle.
Jungle worm? Sure.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank sure, you, Steve. Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.